From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made March 9th, 2014 on CNN.com. A headline breathlessly announced what looked like a breakthrough. Blood test predicts Alzheimer's disease. The key word there is predicts. CNN was reporting that a test showed the capacity not to diagnose Alzheimer's as it was happening later in life, but to discern who among us would be likely to get it. Sometimes the news media reports in that breathless fashion about breakthroughs that are playing out or still haven't fully played out or could happen. In this case, there is certainly reason to be excited about the research and what we are learning about this. Now, one of the members of the team researching this possibility is Mark Mapstone from the University of Rochester School of Medicine. Tonight, Mark helps kick off a new season of lectures at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. It's their Science on the Edge series. His presentation is called The Challenge of Alzheimer's Disease in an Age of Personalized Medicine. But first, he's here on Connections as my guest for the hour, and it's great to see you again, Mark. Thank you.
Hey, thank you for having me.
All right. Well, you and I have talked in the past about, I've been guilty of it. I think anybody in the news media wants to slap that big headline on scientific research, studies, et cetera. And I don't think we can blame people for that, myself included, I hope. But are we getting too far ahead of ourselves? How are things going in terms of this line of research?
Well, yeah, I think we found that there was a great deal of interest in the work we were doing. So, of course, very pleased about that. But I think it really speaks to the importance of the problem that we're trying to address, which is the coming epidemic of Alzheimer's disease, which, as I've often said, we're woefully unprepared for. So I think the grabbing of the headlines was really an indication of the importance of what we're looking at here.
Okay. Well, if listeners, you want to join the program with questions or comments as we talk about Alzheimer's this hour, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. What's the timeline? What is your most optimistic look at the kind of research that's going on now, Mark?
Well, as far as what we're calling preclinical detection of Alzheimer's disease, this has really been the movement in the field over the past probably 2 to 3 years after a very important position paper came out in about 2011. The push has been to try to detect the disease as early as possible in the course of the disease so that we can administer treatments, hopefully therapeutics, to slow down the disease or possibly to stop it in its tracks. So the time frame has been moving rapidly, and there has been a real paradigm shift to looking earlier in the disease. So things are picking up, and I think that we're making great advances, but certainly we need some more time to get to where we need to be.
What is a best-case scenario for the kinds of either tests or biomarkers, products, et cetera, that might be available if this goes down a road that is productive?
Well, I think most people in the field are feeling like we're making some great strides. And so I think as far as a timeline, I'm very bullish on the work that we're doing here. And I think that within 5 to 10-ish years, that we should probably have some viable therapies for this disease. A lot of that depends, of course, on resources being made available to the scientists and to the researchers that are doing this work, because without the funds, without the equipment, without the clinical infrastructure, it's going to be really hard to achieve that sort of a time frame. But I think it can be done, and I think we're on the right track now.
How are you doing the research? What on the physical side of the work, what is happening that would allow you to successfully create this kind of a blood test, et cetera? What is it that we can study and we can use to be able to be successful in predicting or diagnosing?
Well, we there are many ways to go about this, and our approach is really to look for biomarkers, which are really just essentially biological evidence of the disease process that we can take or see in an individual. And our approach has been to use the blood to look for these biomarkers. And we're looking for molecules, small molecules. We happen to focus on lipids or fats in the work that we're referring to that came out last year. But other folks are looking at things like proteins, nucleic acids, different components of the blood that we can find. And the idea is to use the blood as a way to query the underlying biology of the individual so that we can get an idea of what's going on. Other people are looking at things like images of the brain, so complex pictures like MRI scans or PET scans. There are people looking at things that can be found in the cerebrospinal fluid, which is a fluid that surrounds the brain, is in direct contact with the brain. So when you're looking at disorders of the brain, there are a lot of different ways that we can go about it. But our group is interested in looking at things that are readily accessible, cheap and easy to get, and using procedures that most people are familiar with and comfortable with.
The fats, for example, how solid is the evidence that that is the kind of marker that you can look for to say, this tells us something. This tells us something about this individual that, you know, in regards to Alzheimer's disease.
You know, that's a really good question, because when we went into this work looking at biomarkers in the blood, we didn't have ideas about exactly what to look for. And what we wanted to do, instead of going in with a hypothesis and trying to prove or disprove that hypothesis, we actually went in with an open mind and said, let's see what we can find. Scientists usually don't like that approach because it's akin to a fishing expedition. You don't really know what you're going to get. You don't know what you're really looking for, but you kind of just cast about a net and see what you can find. And it turns out that we looks like we were looking in the right place, and we found something very interesting that we hadn't really expected to find. But yet when we look at it more closely, it makes a lot of sense. We found that some lipids were depleted, or there were reduced levels of these fats in the blood of people who would go on to develop the disease within a couple of years. And so what we believe that represents is that these fats, which are critical members of the neurons and other membranes of cells in the brain, are being broken down. And so that these are the earliest signals of this early biological process in the brains of these people.
What was that discovery like?
Well, I think it took us by surprise. Of course, when we stood back and looked at it, it made sense to us. The field really didn't appreciate it at first because it didn't fit with the dominant paradigm in the field, which is—
When you say the field didn't appreciate it, colleagues?
Yeah, colleagues, other scientists looked at it with a bit of skepticism, which they should, as this is how science works. Our work needs to be questioned and validated in other groups. But it really didn't take the traditional path that most people were taking to look for biomarkers. And so people had some skepticism about it. And I think that that has encouraged us to go back and look more closely at our data. And we're reassured to find out that it actually is turning out to hold up the way that we think that it does.
Just increasing the sample size of the research?
Yeah. So the main thing we need to do is to validate our data in another group of people. So if we do an experiment in our laboratory and find a result, it's really important to go out and replicate that experiment in another group or another laboratory or group of subjects. So we're currently doing that, and we have high hopes that that will bear out, that the results are the same. And there's a lot of indication at this point in the field that people have published since we published that are supporting our results as well. So we're feeling like this is going to be replicated, but we still need to wait and see if that's going to happen.
Joni wrote to the program, does your guest need volunteers?
Yeah, we're always looking for volunteers.
You are?
Yeah, absolutely. The AD research, Alzheimer's disease research, is in dire need of people who are willing to participate as clinical subjects in work like mine, but also in other sorts of work as well. For example, in imaging work, taking pictures of the brain, in drug trials, testing new drugs to see whether they're safe and whether they work, and also in normal older adults. It's very important for us to understand individuals who don't have the disease and what makes them not get the disease. So it's sort of the other side of the coin. We're interested in seeing how the disease progresses in people who are going to get it, but also in people who don't get it. There's something about them that their biology is protecting, perhaps, or preventing them from getting the disease, that we need to understand that.
It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994 as we talk about Alzheimer's research and the future of treatment, perhaps, or the future of the kinds of biomarkers that might impact so many people. So DeJoni's question, does your guest need volunteers? Everyone seems to need volunteers in this. How do people sign up?
Well, the easiest way would be to contact the AD Care Program, which is a research-based program out of the University of Rochester. Here locally would be the best place. There's also something called the Trial Match, which is a resource run by the National Institute of Health. And it's on the web. If you just Google or search for Trial Match, you'll find resources for local research that's going on and also research that's going on all over the world. But locally, the AD Care Program, which is located at Monroe Community Hospital, is a good place to start.
Todd writes to us, if we're talking predicting Alzheimer's, I don't think I'd want to know unless there was a cure associated with it. And that's an interesting comment. I'd love to hear from listeners about what you would want to know if you could get a predictive test, even if there wasn't a cure associated with it. First of all, Mark, what do you make of that comment?
That is probably the biggest issue that has been raised after our findings, is really what do you do about a diagnosis or a positive test result in an individual that indicates that they're going to get a disease in a short period of time, say a couple of years, but we have no treatment for the disease. And so what is the utility of that? And how is that going to affect people's lives and their families and their communities? And that is really a debate, a discussion that needs to be had at the societal level, at the government level, at the health payer level, and at the individual level. These are very important questions that need to be brought about, because the age of personalized medicine is coming. And these biomarkers will be implemented down the road. They're the way that we need to go to treat the disease. And so we really have to deal with these issues. And they are substantive. They are not trivial issues.
Okay. Well, you've given us a lot to chew on there. And I want to even explore what the term the age of personalized medicine means. But before we even go there, I don't think we would ever arrive at sort of a blanket agreement on what people would want. I mean, every individual would probably view this differently. You might say, if I'm 30, I don't want to know that I could get Alzheimer's when I'm 60. But if I'm 60 and I'm likely to get it before I'm 65, I want to know. Some people might say, I want all of the information you can give me at any point. And that's, by the way, that's probably where I am. I'm an information person. I think you can make the best decisions you can with information, but others may disagree. We're probably not going to see a universal agreement on that, are we, Mark?
I doubt it. But the idea would be to offer the option and make it available for those people who do want the information, like you and many others who want that information because they think that it informs their ability to live their lives. We have to make it available if those people want it. And those who don't want it can choose not to use it. But it goes a little bit beyond just choosing not to get the information, because there are implications, for example, for healthcare insurance coverage or long-term care insurance.
Yeah.
If there's a test out there that can tell you whether you're going to get the disease, will you be made to take such a test? And what are the implications for denial of benefits?
Boy.
Because people who test positive for the disease are actually the ones who need the care the most. They're the ones that are going to need it.
But they're going to be viewed as we're supposed to be moving past the age of pre-existing conditions.
That's right.
But that still seems like it would be a giant risk that needs to be sort of addressed before we even get into these biomarkers.
Absolutely. And those are the discussions that need to be had on multiple levels, from the federal to the government to the individual healthcare, all of that. But remember, too, that all of this presumes that we don't have a treatment. So in the absence of a treatment, these issues are weighty, they're real. But if this information can get us farther down the path to developing a treatment that's viable, that really works, even if it's just slowing down the disease, it doesn't even have to cure it. There have been many studies that show even if you can slow this thing down or prevent the onset for a couple of years, there can be great benefits to having that knowledge ahead of time and starting these treatments if they're so developed. So we may actually be talking about a short period of time in which we're grappling with the issue, say the next 5 years of having the information available to you, but yet not being able to do anything about it. And then when we use that information to develop a treatment, then the issue becomes less significant, because presumably everybody would want the treatment if they took the test.
Sure. And forgive my ignorance on how this test would function, but if there's certain parts, I hope you can kind of walk me through here. First of all, you're indicating that the test would show a presence of, it sounds to me like it's, for Alzheimer's, it's the disease as opposed to a person's condition which could lead to the disease. As in, I'm going to use terms that are way wrong, but the disease is dormant for now, it will manifest within a couple of years, or it is there already in some form, as opposed to, hey, Evan, you know, our test finds that you are susceptible, or you are likely to contract or to develop. Is that distinction, am I making sense there?
Yeah, that's an important distinction. And I think your point, the latter point you made of it being the disease being present, it just hasn't reached a threshold level yet. And what we're really doing with this sort of a biomarker is to push the threshold back in time of the disease course. Currently, we diagnose Alzheimer's disease based on clinical symptoms. If you show up in my office for a memory evaluation and you have memory impairment, I can diagnose you with Alzheimer's disease if you meet other certain criteria. But until that memory impairment becomes evident to me as a clinician, then you can't meet criteria for Alzheimer's disease. So what we're actually doing is detecting the disease process before you meet certain criteria. So we're pushing the threshold back, which means that the disease is there, it just isn't bad enough yet to make you have memory loss.
There in a way that most people would never recognize it being there.
Probably not, unless you did something like this sort of a test or some of the other imaging, took a picture of the brain.
Right, but your day-to-day behavior or actions probably don't look like they're impacted yet.
By definition.
By definition.
Yes, that's true. And so what we're trying to do is trying to bypass those clinical indicators, those things that we can see and observe, changes in behavior, memory, thinking, bypass those and go straight to the underlying biology, which requires much more straightforward interpretation if we know what we're looking for.
I assume that there is sort of a maybe an average or a routine, I don't know if there's a routine progression for Alzheimer's, but if it does exist, if a test can find it in this really early stage before it's really manifested the way we're commonly used to it, can it be like that for 30 years? Can it be like that for 5? I mean, is this the kind of thing where the test would tell us you're likely to start to see symptoms in X amount of years time?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. It's still an open question. It's something that we don't know based on our work and the work of others at this point. But this push in the field toward preclinical detection, getting it early as possible, has shown us in pretty striking ways that this disease process is probably starting, if not years, probably decades earlier than the onset of memory loss. So just to take that back in time, if we think that the average age of onset for Alzheimer's disease is in the early 70s, say 72, 75, if this disease process is ongoing maybe as early as the 60s or the 50s, some people even believe that this may be a disease that starts, some of the earliest events may start as early as in the young adulthood. Some people way off on the fringe have even thought of this as a disease of childhood. So some of these very, very early events in our lives may predispose certain patterns of underlying biology that over time accumulate as a disease process and emerge as clinical symptoms of memory loss and other behavioral changes at age 75. It just takes that long to get there.
And that's maybe hard for people to hear, that sitting here in your 30s or 40s, you may have Alzheimer's right now. Because, again, the test is described in the headlines as a predictive test, but what it appears to really be is evidence of a very early stage of the disease as it already exists.
Yeah, yeah. And I want to be really careful, too, about talking about this finding that we reported as a test.
Okay.
Maybe just for the listeners to be clear, we don't have a test yet. There is no test. You can't go to your doctor and get this thing. We would love to have a test that's useful. But at this point, the report that we had out last year was really a description of findings of these 10 lipids that we found were depleted in people. And these specific 10 lipids, if you look at them closely and group them together, they were depleted enough that they would predict who is going to get the disease. So we have not developed a test. And as a matter of fact, if you were to apply this test, this particular test, to people who are much younger, say in their 40s, as you mentioned, or 30s, it probably wouldn't be very useful at all, because something called the positive predictive value would be extremely low. And what I mean by that is that we would get many false positives, and we would get enough false positives, meaning people who tested positive indicating that they might have the disease when they actually don't have the disease. We call those false positives. We would get enough false positives to make this test essentially useless, more or less a flip of a coin, roughly 50%. So in highly selected populations, let's say age 70 and older, with a family history of Alzheimer's disease and starting to experience some subtle memory changes, this test might be this result might be useful as a test eventually. But it certainly at this point is not ready for prime time for general screening of the population in much younger ages. However, we would like to get there at some point, and that's where we're shooting, but at this point it's not there yet.
What do you make of it when CNN's headline says, "Blood test predicts Alzheimer's disease"?
I shuddered. It was a little scary, because my knee-jerk reaction was, we're not describing a test. This isn't a test yet. People are going to go crazy asking for a test when we don't have that. And if you actually read the manuscript that was published, we're very, very careful about saying that this work does not represent general screening utility. This is not something you want every 60-year-old to go out to their doctor and get. We don't want to unnecessarily scare people and say that they're positive for a disease that they don't actually have. That's very bad, and that's something we try to avoid. And so we're very careful in the manuscript to say that. But unfortunately, the appetite for information on this front and advances in Alzheimer's disease has really just stirred people up into a lather. So that's where we ended up with that.
Talking to Mark Mapstone, researcher and clinician for the University of Rochester School of Medicine. I see the phone starting to ring. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Does the media do in general a poor job at understanding how to put headlines and articles and pieces together on issues of scientific complexity that, again, we may be moving towards a test, but does the media sort of do a disservice in some ways there, Mark?
Short answer, yes, I think so. It's unfortunate, too, because I think they're in the right place. They want to do the right thing. They want to get the information out. But it seemed a bit like a race to get the sexiest headline out. And I think misinforming the public is actually causing more harm than good here. We're scientists, and so we're very tempered in the way that we approach things, and we don't jump out on the edge. But unfortunately, those results were taken a bit out of context.
The irony is that that kind of headline may be somewhat beneficial to a team of researchers like yourself if it generates this notion that you need more. I don't want to make assumptions that I actually know how the funding mechanisms work. but the point is, I think what we're hearing from Mark is what we all want is an accurate portrayal of what's going on. Well-intended headlines, but maybe disservice if they're misleading.
I think it gets people excited about things that maybe aren't quite there yet. So it's unfortunate, but that's the way that it went down.
All right, let me grab a phone call, and this is Bernard in Fairport. Go ahead, Bernard.
Hi, thanks very much. I guess one of the things that come to my mind when there's these kinds of discussions is we talk about knowing whether somebody has a particular disease. But isn't there also a benefit in knowing how confident you can be saying to somebody, your problem is not Alzheimer's? So doesn't that have a great value, too? Because, you know we can't do anything now about this particular disease, but in your particular case, you don't have that disease, so there must be something else we need to look at. So I'd be interested in your comments on that. Thanks very much.
Yeah, you make a great point, Bernard. the information can be useful both in the positive way, but also in the negative way, in the sense that if you end up with a negative result, that can put the mind at ease for the patient or the person who's having the problems, that they don't actually have this disease. You know, and I think that that's very, very valuable information from a clinical standpoint. I would say that my most frequent patient in my clinic is somebody who's worried about having the disease, forgets their keys one day and then says, oh my gosh, this is Alzheimer's, I've got it. And then there's this downward spiral of depression, and then they start looking for problems. And I think knowing that that's not the issue at that moment can be very, very beneficial for the patient.
Yeah, what a good point that is, because we're so focused on finding the cases that it does exist, and sometimes we miss that other benefit. Marion in Rochester. Go ahead, Marion.
My husband had Alzheimer's, and I was a member of the Alzheimer's group. He died in 95. In the autopsy, it was proven that he had Alzheimer's. So wasn't some blood and other testing things saved and for testing for other people?
It's hard to tell in that particular case, but the diagnosis of Alzheimer's is confirmed upon autopsy.
Yes.
When the patient is alive, we're pretty accurate at determining whether they have the disease or not, at about 95% or so, maybe 90%, depending upon where you are. Mm-hmm. But it's confirmed after autopsy when they can actually look at the tissue. And oftentimes those samples are saved if the patient gave permission to do
yes,
so.
Yes, mm-hmm. Definitely, because I was a member of that. We both were. And I was attesting. I am still going to be tested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are very, very important samples, and that's the kind of participation that we need from the community at large for advancing the field. Our particular interest is in learning about the disease before people actually get the symptoms. And so what we would want is samples from individuals before they have the problem to begin with. So it's a different kind of sample probably than what your husband was able to provide.
Well, I would have thought they would have taken the blood too and different things that they could have.
They may well have, and I'm not exactly sure what happened.
We are so much longer, 95. Yeah.
Well, thanks for the call, Marion, we had a number of comments online just talking about asking questions on whether diagnosis is increasing because we're living longer. I would assume the answer is yes, Mark.
Yeah, that's one of the issues, certainly, is that, with the technologies that we have available, medical technologies, information about nutrition and diet and all of this, we're living longer. You combine that with the fact that this bolus of aging individuals that we know as the baby boomers are now reaching senescence. They're age 65. The first started 65 in 2010. You put that together with the fact that we've got increasing numbers of people who are going to be older and they're living longer, and the main fact that Alzheimer's is an age-related disease, which means that the older you live, the more likely you will get it. You put those three things together, and this is why we call it the Alzheimer's epidemic, because we're really set up by 2050 to have on the order of 13 million individuals in the United States with Alzheimer's disease.
Kate in Pittsford, you're next, and if you want to join the conversation, our listeners, the number is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. You can join the conversation with Mark Mapstone, and we're talking about Alzheimer's disease. Tonight marks the opening of a new season of lectures. It's the Science on the Edge series at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. So tonight, 7:30 p.m., Mark is going to be presenting there with a presentation called The Challenge of Alzheimer's Disease in an Age of Personalized Medicine. He's going to hit on some of the subjects we're talking about here and some other subjects as well. The museum will open at 6:30 tonight, and again, it's at 7:30. Now, if you've gone in the past to this series, bit of a change of setting. It's in the Bausch Auditorium now, and it's going to be more of a sort of an intimate, more of a personalized setting, as we talk about personalized medicine. How's that, Mark? So Mark will be talking tonight. We're going to get a short break in and come right back with you, more of your phone calls, and we'll talk about what the age of personalized medicine really means with Mark Mapstone next on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and Mark Mapstone, a researcher and clinician for the University of Rochester School of Medicine, is in studio with us as we talk about not only the work that he and his team have been doing on Alzheimer's disease, but the broader picture of Alzheimer's disease. And I want to bring in Kate in Pittsford. Go ahead, Kate.
Hi, Evan. Thank you for the segue about personalized medicine. I wanted to just share the fact that Alzheimer's is going to be a tsunami effect, I have no doubt. However, it is incredibly important to remember it is personalized, it's absolutely individualized, and my father fell into the bucket of getting pre-diagnosed with Alzheimer's, which was not Alzheimer's, and you go down the path of certain drugs that have bad interactions, certain things that get exacerbated that shouldn't be, and I thank God for the geriatric and neurology clinic in Rochester, New York at Monroe Community Hospital that puts you through a process that eliminates the possible potential other diseases that it could be, and in his case, it proved to be NPH, which was a totally different protocol and had lots of problems with an Alzheimer's diagnosis. And I find that over and over again in this medical establishment that we have currently today, particularly in Rochester, and it's very, very conservative, you have to absolutely give options to people to look at the very personalized root causes to the types of symptoms that are happening out there. So I love the opportunity for the guest speaker to comment, but I think we have to be very careful when we're on a mission and a path to get this really, really early diagnosis and drop people into this bucket so I can justify a drug application or I can justify my particular research process that I want to prove out, when in essence it might not be. And I think that that just really needs to be taken into effect. I've seen many, many people in nursing homes and institutions, and a lot of people that don't have a say that get put through cases that may not be necessary. And I do understand it's going to be a huge problem and process, and I've worked with other folks in that bucket, in that boat, but please emphasize that there are other things that can be happening that are not necessarily Alzheimer's, but other things that can have a very good turnout in protocol. And in my dad's case, he had an operation that put in a shunt. His memory came back, his ability to walk, his functioning, just tremendous. And we had two grandchildren born during the 5 years that he was with us in a much better capacity. So that's all in my comment, and I'll hang up now so you can let your guest comment.
Yeah, go ahead. Thank you, Kate. Go ahead, Mark. Thanks very much.
Yeah, well, I think that that's a great outcome, and it sounds like the right thing was eventually done in your father's case, and I'm glad to hear that. These diagnoses are very, very difficult to make outside of specialized clinics. And so I think you made the point, Kate, that one needs to have a specialized workup, and I think that that is essential. There are many clinics that do that well here in Rochester, although it sounds like maybe you didn't get to one of those initially, but I think that sort of diagnostic workup is critical and essential to rule out Alzheimer's and to look at other things like NPH, which means normal pressure hydrocephalus, which actually is a reversible form of dementia. And as you found with your father, the shunting actually helped, it sounds like. So glad to hear that that worked out.
She also spoke a little bit more broadly about the notion of making sure that if we're going to be offering any kind of a predictive, and again, I'm trying to use the right words, Mark, because I don't want to be part of the media problem. and let's also just say that Mark and his colleagues can call me anytime if we are over-reporting or missing the mark. So, but I think her point was we want to be careful not to be so aggressive in our desire to see the future of our own health that we end up sort of over-aggressively pursuing these kind of ideas and therefore end up with too many false positives that lead to treatments we don't need and her language was a little bit shaded with some nefarious purposes, but apart from that, let's just talk about the danger of pushing too hard because of false positives. How do you make sure that whatever comes out of this kind of research is going to be sound enough that we aren't going to see, as she said, large people falling into the bucket of sort of a false test?
Yeah, well, this is specifically the reason why headlines cannot be so sensationalistic, because we need to allow science time to do its to do what science does, and that is to thoroughly and rigorously evaluate the data. And when the media jumps ahead of us and provides patients and in the community and society at large with things that we're not quite delivering yet, there's an expectation that we're already someplace where we're not. And science takes time. And the pace of science is often very slow, and it's not as fast as people want it to be. But it's necessary for it to go through what it does so that we are sure about the results that we get. And for example, the procedure to shunt an NPH patient to make their swelling go down is an effective therapy that was born out of science. And so we have those proven therapies because science has told us that they work, and we need time in order to get there. So as much as we're excited about the new things that are on the horizon and working as hard as we can to get there, we do need time to get there, because that's what's going to allow us to make sure that the results are what they are. And we also have stopgaps in place. The FDA is there to protect and to make sure therapies and things like a biomarker test are rigorously demonstrated to be what they say, what we say they are. So, yeah.
Let me take her comment to an extreme. Is there any concern that the medical system would push for this kind of therapy, treatment, biomarker test, et cetera, as a way to sell more drugs?
Well, yeah. I mean, so I heard that undertone in her comment. Certainly the pharmaceutical industry is a very powerful player here. And the pharmaceutical industry, at least in the Alzheimer's disease area, has been burned many times. Over the past few decades, nearly every trial, phase three clinical trial that's been done in Alzheimer's disease has been a failure. It's about a 96% failure rate. And these big pharmas have spent hundreds of millions of dollars per trial. And so when you add this all together, there's a lot on the line here. So there is probably a tendency at that level to push for things that are going to perhaps get them to a better place financially. But that's why academics are different from big pharma. We're not involved in business. We're not there to push a drug or to push a particular technique. We're there for science. I mean, there's truth in this, and our goal is to help people. I don't spend the long hours that I spend in the lab and over the weekends and missing my family because I'm out there making money. If you think we get paid a lot as academics, we don't. It's because I truly think that our goal and our mission can be achieved for helping people can be achieved by doing the work that we're doing. So, yeah, I mean, I think Kate's point is well taken, that there are people who would push such things in order to make a buck. That's not where I'm at, and I don't think that's where most of my colleagues are at.
Back to the phones in Rochester. This is Fred. Go ahead, Fred.
Hi, this is Dr. Fred Marshall. I'm a colleague and longtime friend of Dr. Mapstone's. We've worked together for many years, and I'm on my lunch break from the memory care program where I worked as a clinician at the university. I did want to just clarify, a previous caller mentioned the geriatric neurology and psychiatry clinic at Monroe Community Hospital, and for years there was such a clinic, but at this point the AD care program that Dr. Mapstone referred to is at Monroe Community. That is exclusively a research clinic. All clinical care at the university for patients with memory disorders takes place in what's now known as the memory care program. It's in an outpatient setting at Clinton Crossings and is a joint program between psychiatry, neurology, neuropsychology, such as Dr. Mapstone. We have social work services, and even I think perhaps the only program in the country with a marriage and family therapist on staff. So we've recognized for a long time the importance not only of a research mission, but also of a clinical mission. And with the help of benefaction from the community, we've been able to create a very nice multidisciplinary clinic. Having said that, the burden of actual clinically manifest dementia in the country, as Dr. Mapstone has alluded to, is huge. And in fact, if you look even in New York State, there are more patients with Alzheimer's and related dementias in New York State than there are citizens of Rochester, New York. And the infrastructure clinically to take care of all those patients is often stretched. I'm sure Mark can speak to that. I did want to just clarify for folks that if they're looking for clinical care, there are some excellent clinics in the community, not only at the University of Rochester, but also colleagues in private practice and at other facilities. So, the research is certainly one agenda. Caring for those who are already afflicted with the disease is another major effort on the part of well-meaning clinicians. So, okay.
Yeah, Doctor, thanks for the call. And Mark, yeah. Go ahead.
No, I agree. Thank you, Dr. Marshall, for adding that. I neglected to bring up the memory care program, which serves a very important role in providing care in our colleagues at Unity Hospital and the memory clinics there and at RGH as well.
On line one, this is Gretchen and Henrietta. Go ahead, Gretchen.
Yeah, hi. I joined the program a little late, so I apologize if you've already answered one of my questions. But my mother had a progressive memory loss, and when I spoke to her doctor, who was a geriatrician, about it and asked him if she should be evaluated for Alzheimer's, he said, no, it's really, we're going to treat her the same way, whether we know that or not. So I have two questions. One, was that maybe a mistake, so we don't really know whether Alzheimer's is in the family, so to speak? And secondly, if people are ruled out for Alzheimer's, that doesn't necessarily rule them out for other types of dementia. So being ruled out for Alzheimer's, couldn't that be kind of a false sense of security?
Well, if I remember your first question, it was it a mistake that the geriatrician said, don't worry about it, we'll treat it the same way anyway? Short answer to that is I don't know what the particular doctor was thinking, but it could be that he or she saw something in the presentation that led to the conclusion that maybe this wasn't dementia, that it was something else, and that they were going to go on the right path and just didn't explain that clearly. It might also speak to a little bit of fatalism of some physicians, kind of holdovers who believe that that Alzheimer's and other dementias are sort of par for the course as you get older, and we're just not going to do anything about it. So I don't know exactly how to answer that other than those comments.
She was put on an Alzheimer's medication, but yeah, okay.
Well, then that probably suggests that the physician thought that they were just going to go ahead with this medicine anyway, and really didn't want to bother with the full workup for Alzheimer's or not. But I think that brings it to the second point, which was I think you're getting at this issue of differential diagnosis and the notion that certain symptom sets, meaning memory loss or behavior changes or confusion, can be caused by different underlying diseases. One, the most common in older adults, being Alzheimer's disease, but there are a whole host of other diseases that can cause memory loss. And some of these things in other conditions can be reversible. And so it's important to do a thorough diagnostic workup to determine whether these conditions exist, because some of them can be approached. For example, Kate, who mentioned NPH in her father, that's a potentially treatable condition. Things as simple as depression, late onset depression, can be treated, and if treated effectively, can ameliorate some of the cognitive symptoms that go along with that. So I think, speaking to your point of differential diagnosis, yeah, that makes a lot of sense that we go through those appropriate steps before we label somebody with this particular disease.
My guest is Mark Mapstone, a researcher and clinician for the University of Rochester School of Medicine, and he is speaking tonight at 7:30. Tickets are available at the door tonight at the Bausch Auditorium at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. It's their Science on the Edge series that Do I have it right? Mark's kicking it off, isn't he? So he's kicking off the new season of that. That's tonight again at the Rochester Museum and Science Center at 7:30. The museum doors open at 6:30. Tickets available at the door there, $15, and I think $13 if you are a member there. The Bausch Auditorium is the setting, so it's going to be sort of an intimate setting with Mark talking about the challenge of Alzheimer's disease in an age of personalized medicine. And before I grab one more phone call, let me just ask you, you've touched on the notion of personalized medicine, and I know you're going to talk more about that tonight, but give us a sense for what that means to you.
So personalized medicine, the way that we're using it now, is really used to define an approach to medicine, understanding the biology of individuals in order to cater to and adequately treat those diseases in that particular individual as they come up. So the idea is if we learn information about a particular individual's genetic makeup or their particular proteins that they're producing in their body or metabolites that are present in the body, we can tailor specific medicines to that person rather than to the disease. And so as our understanding of disease complexity gets better, meaning we know that diseases don't affect people in the same way. So your Alzheimer's disease is going to be different from my Alzheimer's disease. Mine may be the most common form with memory loss and word-finding difficulties, but yours may be visual hallucinations and wandering and other features, behavioral features. Although we may call that Alzheimer's disease, they may be due to different underlying pathobiologies. And so the treatments that are out there today for Alzheimer's are not going to work the same in those two different cases. And so we should use different treatments for you and for me. If we understand what your biology is like and my biology is like, then we can tailor those treatments to us individually and hopefully treat the symptoms more efficiently.
All right, let me grab another phone call. John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hello. Have we tried splicing brain nerve microtubules yet?
Splicing brain nerve microtubules?
Yes.
Yeah. No, I'm not sure what that would help us with.
Well, a possible bypass and end run around a blockage caused by Alzheimer's.
I see. So I think what you're referring to, John, is there's the known pathologies of Alzheimer's disease, which are beta amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles. And you're suggesting that maybe splicing some of these microtubules might get us past the neurofibrillary tangle issue.
You might explain to the audience what are the microtubules.
Sure, sure. So the microtubules are transport systems within the neurons that allow the transport of information and proteins and things from one part of the neuron to the next so that they can pass it on to another neuron. And one of the primary features of Alzheimer's disease is there's a breakdown in that transport system, and it's caused by this particular protein called tau. There is no splicing. At this point, we have no way to address things at that sort of scale.
They seem to be too small to be spliced.
Yes, that's exactly my point, is that the scale is much too small to go in and physically do anything. There are ways to probably protect those microtubules so that the tau does not degenerate as rapidly, but there's no way to go in and actually repair broken ones at this point.
If you could, would that be considered a good option?
It would be difficult to implement.
Okay.
I can't conceive right now of a way that one might go about doing that, because there are billions of neurons in the brain, and to go in and individually attack these things would be very difficult.
Interesting. Well, since I've got a couple minutes and we're on the physical part of trying to deal with Alzheimer's, you mentioned, again, looking at lipids, certain lipids that are not there in a blood test. Is that right?
They're depleted.
They're depleted.
Yeah. So these are lipids. These are called phospholipids or phosphatidylcholines, which are very important constituents of the cell membrane. So our neurons, which are the cells in our brains, are made up of layers of a membrane, and then all the other stuff sits inside. When those membranes are broken, then all the stuff that's inside gets out, and all the stuff that's outside gets in, and so therefore the cell dies. And so what we're finding is the building blocks of those membranes are depleted in the blood of people who have, we presume, early disease.
Okay, and is there a feeling then that this not only would be the kind of marker that will help people know that they are in the early stages of the disease, but also then you start to research ways to prevent the degradation of those lipids. Yeah?
Yeah, yeah. So that's one of the easy sort of hypotheses to test is, well, what happens if we just give you more of those phospholipids, perhaps through your diet? So these are things that are found in the diet. What if we give you more of those? Does that mean that your cells can repair themselves? Do they make more of the lipids so that the membranes don't break as easily? That's clearly a route that one should look at in order to possibly treat the disease. So if you have depletions of the lipids in the blood, then we'll give you more. It might not be that simple, and I would be surprised if it was.
Sure.
But, you know, it's obviously something that we should try.
Okay. And so in 30 seconds, if sample size could be you could get the biggest sample size you want and there's no object to achieving funding and all the resources you need, what would you do next, Mark, that would help us down this road?
Well, I'd probably wake up because I'd be dreaming. I'm not sure that would happen. I mean, there are challenges to that. But the next step really is to use this information to enroll patients into clinical trials to test new therapies to slow down or stop the disease.
I mean this when I say it, that I do hope that you and your colleagues will continue to keep us honest in the media, not because I think, again, we are trying to do anything that has a deleterious effect on public discourse about this, but let's not get out of ourselves and keep us in the fray, and then we'll continue the conversation as it happens, because if it's 5 or 10 years away, that's still not that far. I mean, that will be here before we know it, and we'll continue to have conversations along the way.
That sounds good. I'm always welcome, ready to come back.
Well, I hope you will. And I hope that you'll go out and see Mark tonight. You can see him tonight, 7:30, at the Rochester Museum and Science Center at the Bausch Auditorium, their Science on the Edge series. He's talking about the challenge of Alzheimer's disease in an age of personalized medicine. Thanks to our great engineer, Val, today, and all the folks on the staff at City 12. Thanks for watching and listening. I'm Evan Dawson. We'll talk to you Thursday on Member-Supported Public Radio.